In this Australian Catholic Historical Society podcast for October 2023, we hear Dr. Peter Kunich, who's the historian of St. John's College at the University of Sydney, which is on its way to a history. He's introduced by ACHS President Dr. John Carmody, who will also moderate the Q&A.
Today of all days, I think it's important that we acknowledge country. And I'd just like to acknowledge the fact that we meet on unceded Indigenous land, and wherever people are listening throughout Australia, the same thing applies. So we pay respect to all those people. I'm very, very, very pleased today to welcome Dr. Peter Kunich, who used to have the distinction of being our sole overseas member. That's no longer the case, partly because he's semi-retired in England, which is hardly overseas, and also partly in Australia, but also because we have a couple of members in the United States now. So sorry that you've lost that distinction, Peter. But Peter comes to us as a distinguished historian after a long career at the University of Hong Kong, a long academic career at the University of Hong Kong. And he and his wife retired to Britain some years ago, but he seems to be here a lot. And in that respect, he's been appointed as college historian of the St. John's College at the University of Sydney, which is where he was a student. Jim Franklin would say that it was a fool's message, fool's errand to take on such a task, but anyway, we shall soon hear. I don't know very much about St. John's College, being a Queensland graduate, except that I did spend a little bit of time there one January when I used to come down to Sydney regularly to stay with my uncle, Tom Crowley, at Chatswood. But for some reason, he wasn't able to do it that year, so I stayed at St. John's College. And my friend, the late Bob Donnelly, was senior tutor there. And I used to have breakfast with him and John Bernheim, which no doubt didn't recommend me to the yobbos of the medical school who were back in college at that stage. Mention of John Bernheim is still alive. Describes his years as a rector as my wasted years. I don't know whether Peter has any views about that at all. But he's going to be talking today about his approach to St. John's College. He's called it St. John's College on the Way to a History. I could say the personal and professional challenges of writing the history of University College, especially St. John's, but I'll leave him to make those comparisons. Peter, welcome.
Well, thanks, Jack, for that very warm welcome. It's great to be back in Sydney, actually, and it's been made all the more enjoyable by being able to come to meetings of the Society again after a break of many years. I'm also very pleased to be able to present a paper about the history of St. John's College to the Society. This isn't, of course, the first time that the Society has heard a paper about St. John's. My two predecessors as historians of the college, Robert Daly and Tony Carl, both made presentations of their work in previous years. In 1958, at the time of the centenary of the college, Daly gave a talk titled John B. Paulding and the Foundation of St. John's College, which was later published in the Australasian Catholic Record. And in 1992, Carl delivered the Gavin Cashman Memorial Lecture on the topic of Archbishop Vaughan and St. John's College. St. John's has also been mentioned at various times in other papers presented to the Society over the last 30 years. But the link between the Society and the College goes back much further than any of these more recent connections. The first meeting of the Society was held at St. John's on the 28th of November 1940. Not sure whether there's anyone here who would remember that. And the Society continued to meet regularly in the college until it moved to History House in 1942. Indeed, the first meeting was attended by many Johnsmen. The inaugural president was Monsignor Thomas Phelan, a clerical fellow of St. John's, and the vice president was Father John Thompson, the rector at the time. Among the 55 original members of the Society, the so-called foundation members, there were many names associated with the college, including the college architect, Jack Hennessy, lay fellows such as Sir Herbert Schlink and Dr. Charles de Monchot, and clerical fellow Dr. Eris O'Brien, who actually gave the first address to the society. Later, our former student and clerical fellow, Monsignor Con Duffy, became president of the society in 1953, and today another former student and past fellow, Professor Jim Franklin, is our vice president and journal editor. Now, I think I'm the only current member of the college, or the current resident member of the college, who is active as a member of the society. But I know that our current chairman of the college council did history and law as an undergraduate 40 years ago, so I think I should perhaps start with him to see if I can rustle up some more support for the society. I have to acknowledge today Dr. Harding Burns, who's joined us for today's event, and I spoke with Harding earlier this week. He is our most senior member of the college, so I'm very glad, Harding, that you were able to come today. And please correct me if I'm if I'm wrong on any of the points that I make. Well, when Jack asked me to speak to the society about St John's, I was at first a little reluctant, as I'd only just taken up my post as college historian, and so we agreed on this rather non-committal title of today's paper, because I wasn't sure what I'd have to say about the college's history with only 1 year of research behind me. Of course, I've now spent so much time in the various archives that I could talk to you for hours about the extraordinary events that the college has witnessed over the last 165 years and the various problems that I've encountered in working out how to write about that history, as Jack has already alluded to. What I've decided to present to you today, however, is a sort of prehistory of the current college history project, because as I began to sift through the archives, both here in Sydney and overseas, I realised that an enormous amount had already been done over the last 100 years in preparing the ground for me. In fact, throughout this first year of research, I've often been following closely in the footsteps of my two predecessors. Now, I know that the phrase standing on the shoulders of giants is one that's perhaps a little overused these days, but I want to use today's talk as an opportunity to acknowledge those who've gone before me in writing the history of St John's, before considering some of the challenges that faced me in telling the story today. We must start, therefore, with previous attempts at writing the history of the college. The first serious attempt to record the history of the college occurred in 1909, at the time of the ill-fated Golden Jubilee celebrations. Commemoration activities in 1908 had been severely limited because of the sudden illness of Cardinal Moran, and this, of course, meant that any show of triumphalism would have been considered to be in very bad taste. So the College Council instead decided to tag its anniversary events onto the meeting of the Third Australasian Catholic Congress, held in Sydney during September and October 1909. The rector, Monsignor James O'Brien, delivered a short paper at the Congress which used the history of the college as a vehicle for fundraising. And of course, this is nothing unusual. While boasting that the college had produced 118 graduates since 1888, which actually is only about three a year, so it's not such a great boast, who were now occupying high positions in the learned professions, he lamented that only three scholarships were available in the college and no bursaries, a situation that contrasted rather unfavourably with the other colleges, which were said to be richly endowed with scholarships and bursaries. St John's was a poor place. Unfortunately, his appeal fell on deaf ears. Neither the ailing Cardinal Archbishop nor the fellows of the college had much interest in fundraising, and O'Brien was too old to undertake a proper fundraising campaign. So this first attempt to use the history of the college as a lever to open the wallets of wealthy donors was sadly unsuccessful. The next rector fared a little better than O'Brien. The talented Father Maurice O'Reilly set to work at fundraising soon after arriving back from Ireland in 1915. He quickly assessed the needs of the college, which at that time were many, and by early 1917 had raised enough money for a start to be made on the construction of a new wing. But when he approached Archbishop Kelly for permission to launch a major fundraising campaign within the Archdiocese, he received a firm rebuff. At this time, Kelly was determined to complete the nave of St Mary's Cathedral and felt that any other appeal would detract from this great work, which had been going on since the 1860s, so it was a long time finishing St Mary's. Moreover, O'Reilly had become a thorn in the side of the New South Wales hierarchy over the conscription debate that was raging at that time. The situation became even worse in the middle of 1918 when both O'Reilly and his vice-rector, Michael O'Farrell, who would be Bishop of Bathurst later on, together resigned, creating a major upheaval in the college and a potential scandal for the church as a whole. This situation prompted a searching review of the Archbishop's powers as visitor to the college in an attempt to assess what action Kelly could take in addressing the issues of student indiscipline that had arisen in previous years. But any further preparation for a canonical visitation of the college was interrupted in November 1918 when O'Reilly was threatened with excommunication over remarks made at a political rally in defence of Irish internees. So there's a stormy relationship between the Archbishop as visitor and the rector of the college. Now, O'Reilly eventually won this particular round in an increasingly poisonous battle with his metropolitan, but it permanently soured the relationship between the two men and gave Archbishop Kelly a rather jaundiced view of the college, one that other archbishops have also held. When Kelly finally announced his intention to make a visitation of the college in the middle of 1919, he asked O'Reilly to submit a report that included a history of St John's with a fuller account of O'Reilly's own successes, hopes and difficulties as rector. Now, it seems curious to me that Archbishop Kelly, who'd been in Sydney since 1901 and must have been aware of Monsignor O'Brien's previous historical work on the college, should have asked O'Reilly to supply him with yet another brief history of St John's. But O'Reilly willingly complied with the request and related with some relish how the inaction of ecclesiastical superiors had allowed the appalling state of the college's finances and buildings to develop. After summarising the triumphal beginnings of St John's, he emphasised that Cardinal Moran had never allowed an appeal for the college to be conducted within the Archdiocese, even though that had been promised in 1887. And he proceeded to relate to Kelly how this had affected the college. And I'm going to quote at length here. This is O'Reilly. "Firstly, the college drifted into a dreadful condition of disrepair. The place became so dirty as not to be decently habitable. Secondly, there was a kind of understanding between the rector and the council that the former would hold himself responsible for any deficit that might result from the working of the college. And as the council could hardly make any suggestion for the betterment of the place that would not cost money, it was inevitable that they should in practice relinquish all control of the college." Now, O'Reilly felt that this situation had had a disastrous impact on the institution, and I continue quoting from him. "Discipline had ceased to exist. The reputation of the college, even at the university, had become unsavoury. And it was plain to anyone, even slightly acquainted with the facts, that there was trouble ahead for whoever should try to introduce any discipline, no matter how lax." And so, with Father O'Reilly's short history of the college in 1919, we see for the first time a formal recognition of the problem that every succeeding historian of the college has faced. How can a responsible historian aspire to write a true account of St John's, warts and all, without causing serious embarrassment to both the institution itself and also to the wider church, particularly its hierarchy? Maurice O'Reilly was writing confidentially for an audience of one, Archbishop Kelly, a prelate whom he hoped would be part of the solution of the college's financial woes. So he could face the facts honestly. Later writers, however, would find the employment of such honesty more problematic. O'Reilly might have contemplated writing a fuller history of the college had he lived longer, but even his projected biography of Cardinal Moran, commissioned by the bishops of New South Wales in the 1920s, never saw the light of day before O'Reilly's death in 1933. It was therefore O'Reilly's successor, Father John Thompson, who was left to attempt a more public assessment of the college's history, first for the fundraising efforts of 1936-38 that saw the completion of the Freehill Tower and the 1938 wing, and later in time for the college's centenary celebrations in 1958. The 1936 appeal booklet, which included an historical account titled, wait for it, St John's College Through the Years, Thrilling Story of the Past. This account necessarily papered over some of the issues that O'Reilly had raised with Archbishop Kelly 20 years earlier. This, after all, was a fundraising document that had to be palatable to the wider Catholic community in Sydney and beyond. Thompson's surprisingly substantial historical account relied heavily on the earlier work of Monsignor O'Brien and a judicious trawling of the college archives for suitable material. But it was first and foremost a triumphalist account of the college's role in the local Catholic educational context, unashamedly published as a vehicle for the fundraising campaign. Constituting the Catholic Church's official contribution to the sesquicentenary celebrations of New South Wales in 1938, the St John's completion appeal had to be a cause for pride rather than embarrassment. And this project was the Catholic Church project for the 150th anniversary celebrations of the state, so very important that a good job was done. Thompson's potted history was therefore upbeat and forward-looking, with a peroration that sought to enthuse the faithful to contribute to a project that was struggling to gain traction after the lean years of the Great Depression. And I'd just like to quote that last section of Thompson's history. He said, "It would crown all the labours of bishops, priests and people in the past if our university college were so endowed as to open the highest careers to the poor but brilliant scholar, and so equipped as to enable it to take its pride of place, for we should not willingly acquiesce in anything lower, among the affiliated colleges of the university." Thompson's account therefore confined itself to an almost entirely positive retelling of the institution's troubled past, while simultaneously appealing to the deep-seated persecution complex of Sydney's post-colonial Catholic community, in pointing out that a serious need for extension and modernisation was required if the college's prospects for the future were to be realised. So a very upbeat and rather fanciful history. The idea of a more rigorous approach to the history of St John's at the time of the college's centenary in 1958 seems to have originated with Robert Daly, a tutor in agricultural science who had joined the college as a freshman from Albury in 1945 and later became one of the stalwarts of the newly formed Johnsmen's Association. Daly started serious research with Father Thompson's blessing in the middle of 1954, having first been given permission by the rector and fellows to read the council minutes and consult other confidential documents stored in several old filing cabinets and presses in the rector's office. Daly later stated that the main purpose of his historical research was to ensure that the facts were right for the functions associated with the 1958 celebrations. But by 1958, he'd commenced writing up his research notes into articles that appeared in the Catholic Weekly and the Australasian Catholic Record. These initial articles, in turn, were soon expanded into a substantial manuscript titled 100 Years on Grocer's Farm, covering the first century of the college's history. By the time Daly left the college at the end of 1960, he'd completed 8 chapters of the manuscript, covering the period 1858 to 1915. His approach, not surprisingly, was chronological and very comprehensive, and included two appendices which are still being used by the college today. In fact, those appendices I use almost every day. They're full of facts that that can't be disputed. The original manuscript that he produced was probably around 180,000 words in length, so really very substantial. But in its current edited version, extends to approximately 150,000 words, which is still a long manuscript. It was an impressive achievement for an agricultural scientist who worked on it in his spare time. It includes a fairly full apparatus of footnotes and references, but the manuscript was considered to be far too long, obviously, but also overcrammed with lengthy quotations and really not suitable as a published book. Serious editing would be needed if it were to be shaped into a successful history of the college. Moreover, it treated the college's history with kid gloves. Not so much triumphalist in its approach as Thompson's had been, but reverential in the extreme, for fear of upsetting any of the various stakeholders, whether within the college or in the wider church in Sydney. Now, it's not clear to me exactly what Bob Daly expected the college to do with his manuscript. When he departed from the college in 1960, he left one original copy and an amended carbon copy with the rector, Dr. John Bernheim, who's already been mentioned today. When Dr. Bernheim resigned in 1968, he in turn passed the manuscript to the new rector, Father Greg Meir. Now, Father Meir was keen to arrange for Daly's history to be published, so he edited the entire text, and by early 1977 had ensured that the whole manuscript was retyped in the hope that early publication would make Daly's work more widely accessible to the broader college community. Now, Daly wasn't terribly happy about this. He was actually somewhat put out by the ruthlessness of Father Meir's editing and tidying up of the original text, but he nevertheless agreed to make corrections to the typescript as a preliminary stage before publication could be considered. So things were quite well advanced towards publication in 1977-78. The project didn't proceed, however, because Daly was at that time working in Canberra as a busy civil servant and wasn't able to arrange to have a meeting with Father Meir so that the necessary corrections could be started. So the project languished. Now, Father Meir wasn't the only person interested in the publication of a college history in the 1970s. Monsignor Con Duffy, who'd been a student at the college in the early 1920s before commencing studies for the priesthood, and who'd also served as a fellow in the college during the 1950s and the 1960s, and had even stood as a candidate in the rectorship election in 1958, was also keen to produce a history of the college. And as you all know, Monsignor Duffy's credentials as an historian were impeccable, having earned doctorates in divinity and ecclesiastical history before serving for many years as president of our society. At the centenary mass for the college in 1958, Duffy repeated Pope Leo XIII's pronouncement about the purpose of history. The first law of history is that it dare not tell an untruth. The second law, that it dare not omit a truth, nor lay itself open either to favour or to hatred. As president of the Australian Catholic Historical Society, Duffy had wanted as many of its members as possible to investigate the history of the church in Australia and to test what was already known against new evidence which was then emerging. His attitude was that if such research upset cherished beliefs about the Catholic past, then so be it. He saw the role of the society as being a forum for these difficult discussions in the march towards a more scholarly approach to church history. If he'd ever got round to writing a history of the college then, I think it's unlikely that he would have been in the same, he would have used the same approach as Daly's reverential sort of college history. By the early 1970s, Duffy had risen through the priestly ranks to occupy the positions of Director of Catholic Education and Chancellor of the Archdiocese under Cardinal Gilroy. But it was his long tenure as Archdiocesan Archivist between 1964 and 1983 that gave him access to a treasure trove of documentation about the college that had been seen by very few other people. Now, it's not clear exactly when Monsignor Duffy became seriously interested in writing the college's history, but I suspect it was probably around the same time that Greg Meir was editing the Daily Manuscript for publication. Because in June 1976, Duffy asked Gerard Windsor whether he'd consider being his co-author on the project. As far as I can tell, nothing ever happened with this project of Con Duffy's, and I see a head wagging, so that's good confirmation. Soon after succeeding as rector in 1980, Les Cashin appears on the scene and began planning with the Johnsmen's Association for the college's 125th anniversary in 1983. Now, central to Les Cashin's plan was the publication of a history of the college, but neither he nor the association had a clear idea of how this could be achieved in the short amount of time that they had. Les therefore met with the two people who were known to have an enduring interest in the college's history, Bob Daly and Tony Carl, in July 1981. Tony Carl had joined the... I think most of us remember Tony Carl. Tony had joined the college as an undergraduate in 1953 and had later taken a second bachelor's degree at Oxford before being appointed to a teaching post in the history department at Sydney University in 1963. Carl had been closely involved with Daly in the production of the centenary edition of the Johnsman's Magazine in 1958 and had also worked very closely with both Monsignor McGovern and Monsignor Duffy in the Archdiocesan Archives while he lived as a tutor at St John's during the 1960s. The outcome of Father Cashin's meeting with Daly and Carl was an agreement that Tony would produce a book manuscript by 1983. The first half of which would be a reduced version of Daly's work up to 1915, and the remainder, Carl's own history of the college up until around 1958. However, after reading Daly's manuscript, Carl concluded, and I quote, "It was just not suitable for publication in its present form, and it needed quite drastic editing and rewriting." Tony's private notes were even more damning. "Basically chronicle, great chunks of undigested quote, poorly structured, important things don't come through clearly, lots of historical questions central to the college neither raised nor answered. Ye old style of history." So Tony wasn't impressed with what he read. Despite his critical opinion of the 20-year-old Daly manuscript, Carl had been good friends with Bob Daly for a very long time and felt that some level of cooperation was needed if the project were to be brought to fruition with a proper recognition of all the work that Bob Daly had done. I quote from Tony again, "I don't want to hurt him by saying the sorts of things a professional historian would be likely to say after reading his work. I have, in fact, worked over the same ground as Bob has covered. But it would be ridiculous for me to ignore what Bob has done. And more important, it's not something I could contemplate doing to an old mate. If I'm to go ahead with the project, I must do it with Bob's cooperation in some form." And I think you'll recognise Tony from that quotation, not wanting to upset his old mate. By the end of 1981, the College Council expressed its intense satisfaction that Carl was willing to take over the project. He was given full access to all the confidential materials in the College's archive, and a joint committee of the Council and the Johnsmen's Association was appointed to guide the work, with Justice Nagel and Charles Abercrombie as the main liaison persons. Carl refused, however, to accept any remuneration for the work, in fear that the project would be forced into a preconceived interpretation or be represented as an official history of the college. He explained his approach to members of the Johnsmen's Association in this way. You see, I would be trying to write something that my historian colleagues would recognise as history, and that this would involve dealing with difficult aspects of the college's past, and in parentheses he says, I had no idea then just how difficult some aspects of the college's past and present would become. I said I'd be happy to circulate draft chapters for comment and, of course, to have factual errors corrected, but that I would not submit to censorship. So Tony was at pains to point out that it would be his own history, and not an official history, but, as with all history, only a history and not the history of the college. Tony made fairly good progress on his research in the early months of 1982, but as the year progressed, his teaching and administrative duties became more onerous, and he was not able to devote as much time to the project as he'd hoped. By the end of the year, he felt that the whole project was, and I quote, a mess. But he nevertheless hoped that in the early months of 1983, he'd be able to find adequate time to complete a large portion of the research and start writing. Now, despite these self-deprecating comments, Tony slowly amassed a very large pile of notes from his research in the college archives, and he went on a photocopying spree at the Archdiocesan archives, presumably with Monsignor Duffy's blessing. I feel certain, however, that Monsignor Duffy would not have given his blessing to the removal of a large envelope full of archdiocesan archival materials from the 1920s. All of these materials are now in the college archives, filling three very large boxes. Tony was planning to write a book of 10 chapters, seven of which were going to be chronological and three of them thematic, with a projected length of 114,000 words. Rare photographs and documents dribbled in from Old Boys throughout 1982 and 1983, and by the middle of 1983, Father Cashin was asking whether Carl wanted to undertake oral history interviews with the surviving alumni from the period 1923 to 1942, all of whom appeared to have remarkable alertness of mind and memory, and who'd been prominent in the affairs of the college in both academic and sporting spheres. Carl, however, was not too keen on the time-consuming interviewing of alumni. But there was more good news. In July 1983, Father Edmund Campion indicated an interest in publishing the completed history in his Studies in the Christian Movement series of books. And I don't know, Ed, whether you remember that, but certainly in the archives it says you're interested. By this time, however, Carl had fallen ill, and not a word had yet been written. He'd missed his deadline to produce the history of the college by the end of 1983, but worse was yet to come. In 1984, Tony's wife Robin was diagnosed with a brain tumour, and she needed a great deal of care during her recuperation over the next few years. While he didn't give up entirely on the project, progress virtually ground to a halt in the mid-1980s as health issues began to dominate Tony's life. So work on the college history had really come to a standstill by 1985 when I arrived at St John's as a postgraduate student and tutor in history. At this time, I didn't actually know about Tony Carl's commission to write a history of the college, but within a few days of taking up residence, Les Cashin gave me a copy of Bob Daly's manuscript and asked for my opinion on whether it might be used as the basis for an up-to-date history of the college. I didn't actually realise then that I was stepping into a minefield of controversy about Bob Daly's history. I was already interested in the history of the college, so he didn't have to put me under too much pressure to get me to read the manuscript. And like most people who've read the Daly manuscript, I told Father Cashin that it was a little outdated in both approach and content, but that it might be further edited and revised to accord with modern expectations of an institutional history. I also emphasise that I was not the right person to undertake the project because I had my own dissertation on 16th century English monastic history to write. Nevertheless, I agreed to do some research on Archbishop Vaughan while I was working in the English Benedictine archives, not realising that at that time Tony Carle was also engaged in writing biographies of Archbishop Vaughan and Cardinal Moran. There was a lot that I didn't know in the mid-80s about the background that I'm now discovering for the first time. When I returned from my overseas research trip in late 1986, I barely had time to prepare a lecture on the college's history, focusing on the Benedictine period, before I left again to start my doctoral studies in England. And that was virtually the end of my involvement in this area. Now, it's evident from correspondence preserved in the college archives that Tony Carle didn't give up on the project, despite the increasingly irksome demands of both work and home life. But he found it very difficult to find the time he needed to devote to the project and to devise a way of writing about the college's troubled past and present that would be both faithful to his professional ethics as an historian and yet not create too much scandal among Johnsmen. He lamented that, and I quote him here, "I fear that the theme emerging in what I've written is one of failure. And I suspect that's not what either the College Council or the Johnsmen's Association Committee want to invest in." It's a very significant statement, that a history of failure. And yes, Jack, it makes life difficult for a historian. While Tony was worrying about how he could write the history of the college, Bob Daly had not given up hope that his own manuscript would one day be published, at least in some form. When Les Cashin retired in 1992, he left the Daly manuscript in the custody of the new rector, Father Barry Tunks. And Daly wrote to Tunks in February 1992, enclosing an amended copy of Chapter 7, which Father Meir had got wrong. Daly was now retired and living in Queensland and had plenty of spare time on his hands to revise the entire original manuscript, which he found to be full of mistakes of one kind or another on 362 pages of the 525-page manuscript. But once the manuscript had been corrected, Barry Tunks was able to get the support of a number of the fellows to proceed with publication of an edited version with Collins Dove of Melbourne. But he was worried because almost 80 years of the college's history had not been covered in Daly's manuscript. And obviously, a full college history would require a lot more work. He was also aware that Les Cashin had initiated discussions with Tony Carle in the early 1980s and that considerable work had already been done by him. So towards the end of 1992, Tunks contacted Tony Carle asking for his views on a proposal for publishing the college history in three volumes. So Father Tunks had devised this scheme whereby the Daly manuscript and Tony's work could be published separately rather than in a single volume. The first volume would be a rewritten and heavily edited version of Bob Daly's history, which Tunks felt could be shaped by a good editor into a very satisfactory volume. Volume 2 would cover the Vincentian era between 1915 and 1958 and would be based on an MA dissertation to be completed by a student under Carle's supervision. The third volume would cover the modern era and would again perhaps be completed by an MA student. But Tunk suggested that Carle should write an epilogue drawing the three volumes together and perhaps pointing to the future. All these suggestions were made with great respect by Tunks, in the knowledge that the idea of a college history had been close to the hearts of both college historians for many years. But to get the project rolling, Tunks sent the Daly manuscript to Collins Dove, who commissioned one of the best editors in the business, Elizabeth Wood Ellam, to evaluate the manuscript. Her report recommended that half the text should be cut and the chapters should be significantly rearranged. She felt that Daly's strength as an author was in his analysis of character, so she advised that his biographical vignettes should be retained, even if some readers might disagree with his conclusions, and that his distinctive writing style should also be preserved. Heavy editing would be required to get the manuscript into shape, but she was prepared to work on the project for a very large fee. At this point, Tony Carle poured cold water on the project, telling Father Tunks that the three-volume proposal was unworkable because of the uncertainty of finding two postgraduate students to complete the necessary MA research. He did, however, at this point, agree that the Daly manuscript could be fairly quickly updated and edited, and he agreed to restart work on his own history of St John's if he were able to get sabbatical leave in 1994. Now, Father Tunks resigned as rector in 1994, and so far as I can see, nothing more was heard of either the three-volume or the two-volume versions of the history that he had anticipated. A renewed approach to Tony Carle was made by Father John Hill in 2001, but by this time, Tony had retired from Sydney University and was now dealing with serious mobility problems brought on by post-polio syndrome. He'd also decided that his biography of Cardinal Moran must be given top priority among the several research projects that remained uncompleted. Sadly, Tony died on the 9th of January 2004, with only a very short section of his History of St John's dealing with Archbishop Vaughan published. Now, I've made a thorough search of Tony's papers, and I've been able to confirm that Tony completed a huge amount of research, actually, on the college history, but his written output was very limited indeed. Hardly anything, in fact, was written. While Tony had been experiencing worsening health in the late 1990s, Bob Daly found ample time in retirement to pursue his historical interests, including the St John's project. As he began to realise that Tony was never going to complete the history of St John's, Daly became dogged in his pursuit of successive rectors in the hope that his own history would be published one day. Almost every year, Bob Daly sent a letter to the rector, and I can just imagine, and I can see that the current rector is in the audience here, the rector must have worried when he received these letters every year. What am I going to do with this Bob Daly guy? After Tony's death in 2004, Daly became determined to continue with the work of the college history that he'd abandoned in 1960. After 40 years, he still retained all of the research notes that he'd amassed in the 1950s, and he immediately set to work completing the unfinished chapters of 100 Years on Grocer's Farm. He was able to send Chapter 9 to the new rector, David Daintree, in late 2004, and chapters 10 and 11 followed very quickly afterwards in 2005. At the end of the process, he confided in Daintree, and I quote, "Tony Carle's death caused me to emerge from my burrow. Now I can retreat again." But he didn't retreat entirely. Daly maintained a periodical correspondence with David Daintree and assisted him on numerous occasions by providing information on various aspects of the history of the college. And his long correspondence with the college archivist, Dr. Perry McIntyre, indicates that he and McIntyre would probably have succeeded in publishing his book, except for a lack of interest on the part of the college after 2012. And you can imagine all of these things are difficult to publish when you're saying that the college council was not interested or perhaps had other things on its mind. At the time of his death in 2016, Daly's manuscript still lay in the college archives gathering dust. Well, between 2013 and 2018, the College Council was caught up in the long and controversial process of drafting a new act to replace the one that had brought the college into existence in 1858. But perhaps partly as a result of the intense negotiations that facilitated this radical change to the governance of the college, several people suggested that a history of the college should again be commissioned. as St John's turned a new leaf in its history and faced the future with a feeling of greater confidence. The new council was in place by March 2019, but it wasn't until the middle of 2020 that a history working group was formed to investigate the way forward in commissioning a history. Now, I joined that working group from Hong Kong by Zoom in July 2020, and I was eventually engaged by the council as the college historian in March 2021. With a brief to commence work on the history in August 2022 and to submit my manuscript on the 31st of May 2025. The Rector and Fellows have commissioned me to write a comprehensive history of the College according to the highest professional and academic standards. As far as I'm aware, the book will not be used for fundraising purposes, nor is there any major anniversary coming up that it would be used to celebrate. We've agreed that no area of the College's history, no matter how contested or controversial, should be out of bounds, and that this is not going to be an official history of the College, but rather my interpretation of the institution's history. And as I look back over the negotiations that we were, as they unfolded, I keep seeing phrases and words that appear in Tony Carl's correspondence as well. So this is what I mean by being on a well-worn path by my predecessors. So there's no expectation that I'm going to adhere to a preconceived official line in my interpretation of the evidence, nor that I should have a favourable or neutral treatment of the evidence. And I feel that this is one area in which the College has matured as an institution since the 1980s. And I might actually extend that and say that I think that the Church as a whole, perhaps, has matured a great deal since the 1980s. So I find myself not having the same worries as Tony Carl when he suspected that he might be forced to adopt a particular line when dealing with difficult topics, nor of Bob Daly, who worried about the College's history causing scandal within the Church. And this is just as well, because there are dozens of difficult topics to deal with in the history of St John's, which will, of course, generate differences of opinion and perhaps even cause a modicum of scandal, if such things happen these days. You'll not be surprised to hear that I've already uncovered many episodes in the history of the College that are either controversial to a greater or lesser extent, or else cast the Church in a poor light. The College was in one sense established as a result of the internecine turbulence resulting from attacks on Archbishop Poulding by the anti-Benedictine Freeman's Journal in the mid-1850s. This is a battle, which I'm sure you're all aware of, that still rages today among historians, who tend to support one or the other side in this rather unseemly fracas that did much to damage the Church in early New South Wales. Likewise, many of you will be aware of Robert Lehane's biography of Father John Forrest, the second rector of St John's, and the way in which it seeks to perpetuate the animosity that existed in the 1870s between the so-called Benedictine and Irish parties in the colonial Church, painting Vaughan as a power-obsessed and anti-Irish autocrat who would do anything to gain control of the College. In my view, Vaughan deserves a more balanced assessment, something that Tony Carl certainly would have agreed with. Moving beyond this period of unseemly contestation into the halcyon days of Cardinal Moran's episcopate, however, I've also found ample evidence of dissension and division. Like Vaughan, Moran was determined to gain control of St John's, but unlike his predecessor, the great Irish Cardinal Archbishop ultimately failed. He supported the second Jesuit attempt to gain control of the College in 1885 and did everything he could to undermine the College Council through deploying the clerical fellows to support his particular aims. Along the way, he made life a misery for the last Benedictine rector, Father David Barry, and as I've earlier suggested, gained his revenge on the College by preventing it from raising much-needed funds to complete the original building scheme. Even Monsignor O'Brien, the Vice President of All Hallows College Dublin, who was handpicked as rector by Moran's close friend, the Archbishop of Dublin, was abandoned to fend for himself in the lean years of the Depression during the 1890s. And I'm afraid I have to admit that the more I read about Moran in the files of correspondence relating to the college, the less I like him. The toxic controversies between Archbishop Kelly and Father Maurice O'Reilly have already been mentioned this afternoon. But we move into calmer straits during the 1930s and 1940s when Father Thompson established a much more positive relationship with both Archbishop Kelly and Cardinal Gilroy. Despite his efforts, however, the fundraising campaign of 1936-38 was actually an almost complete failure. Indeed, Father Thompson, despite his good relations with both of his metropolitans, was in many ways a disaster as rector. Another difficult conclusion to come up with. By 1958, the college was in desperate need of repair, modernisation and expansion, and the undergraduates were starting on their trajectory of unbridled defiance against the authority of both the rector and the council. The 1960s, then, were a time of deep despair because of the excesses of the fresher system, in spite of progress in modernising and extending the fabric of the college. And as you all know, these problems continued well into the 1990s and really are a permanent blight on the reputation of the institution and ultimately, of course, the trigger for reform after Cardinal Pell's dramatic sacking of the College Council in 2012. So Cardinal Pell's action, I think, can be construed as the final battle in a war that had been waged for a century and a half between the College Council and the Archbishop Visitor. Even after 2012, the controversies continued, with opposing views from different stakeholder groups as to how the college should be governed in the 21st century. These are arguments, I have to say, which still haven't been laid to rest, even after the new Act was introduced in 2018. I therefore find myself considering the same questions that exercised Bob Daly and Tony Carl, as they struggle to find a way of telling a story that is quite often, as Tony said, a history of failure. In my view, it's not actually a story of total failure, thank goodness, but the numerous and embarrassing episodes of failure must nevertheless be explored fully and explained if the history of the college is to have any enduring meaning to a modern audience. Bob and Tony had their own ways of dealing with this problem of interpreting the past. But if we go back to Pope Leo XIII's injunctions on the writing of church history, I wonder whether both of them were being just a little too cautious in their approaches. Pope Leo insisted that, and I quote, "The historian of the church has a duty not to dissimulate any of the trials which the church has had to suffer from the faults of her children and even, at times, from those of her ministers. Historical work must always be scientific," he said, "presenting a true and fearless record of facts. It must be scientifically compiled and never subservient to party interests, not even when these interests concern the good name of the church." Leo XIII, therefore, had complete faith in the outcome of this scientific historical method. I quote again, "Let bare assertions be displaced by the fruits of a painful and careful research, rashly formed judgments by the outcome of serious study, and frivolous opinions by the criticism of wisdom. Truth, in spite of persistent opposition, must triumph in the end." So, with Pope Leo XIII as my guide and my support, I feel that I have nothing to fear, either from church leaders or from collegiate authorities, as I pursue the history of St. John's College. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, Peter. The challenges of history. It was after a very good lunch, like a year or so ago, that I persuaded Peter that he should give us a talk on the history of St. John's, since he had just undertaken the role. And I'm very glad that I did and he was susceptible to persuasion. So we've got time for questions or discussion, whether you're a Johnsman or not.
Peter, thank you very much. We had another presentation not so long ago by Gerard Windsor on the challenges of writing the Riverview history, and it's just lovely to put that into context, and of course the challenges that historians face in any public history endeavour, and possibly even the challenges that our own society will face as it is writing its own history at the moment as well. But thank you. I've got a couple of questions, but the one that I'm quite interested in, that period of Maurice O'Reilly, and you mentioned that he was threatened with excommunication around about 1918, I think it was. And, of course, he was a very close associate of Mannix. Yeah. And I'm just wondering whether you might be able to just shed a little bit more light on what happened there and how it was managed to be resolved.
Yeah. So Maurice O'Reilly was thought of as being Archbishop Mannix's lieutenant in New South Wales. And there was a huge storm of controversy with Judge Hayden in 1918 when Archbishop Mannix came and spoke at the foundation stone ceremony of the new wing of the college. O'Reilly was absolutely delighted because this caused controversy and he loved controversy. But of course, Archbishop Kelly hated controversy and wanted, a quiet life. So already at the beginning of 1918, there was serious trouble between O'Reilly and Kelly. What then happened, as you will probably be aware, O'Reilly becomes very involved in the discussions about what's happening in Ireland. And O'Reilly's mood changed in 1916 with the Troubles. And so by 1918, there were patriots who had been interned in Ireland, and a committee was formed here in Sydney to raise money for these internees to help them out and their families. And O'Reilly was one of the key speakers and agitators in this movement to help the internees. Now, there had been a papal pronouncement about priests becoming involved in political movements. And even though this had been rescinded under the revision of the canon law, a couple of clerics in Sydney decided that O'Reilly could be got at through this particular papal pronouncement. So Kelly was told, incorrectly as it turned out, that he could excommunicate Maurice O'Reilly unless he retracted everything that he'd said at this public meeting about the... because it seemed that he was supporting a Fenian sort of underground movement, and this was, the Fenians were outlawed at this time. But as it turned out, Kelly didn't have the authority to excommunicate O'Reilly, and it was Monsignor Coonan, who was the Vicar General, examined the case, and he said very respectfully to Archbishop Kelly, "Well, I'm sorry, Your Grace, but you don't have any grounds to be persecuting Father O'Reilly. You're going to have to apologise to him." And this, of course, started a whole new correspondence where O'Reilly wrote back and said, "Your Grace, you haven't apologised enough. You need to be much more contrite than you are."
That sounds just like it.
It was a ping-pong game between O'Reilly and Kelly then right up until O'Reilly's death in 1933. The two of them were at daggers drawn through most of that period. And that was very, very unfortunate for the college because... even though Kelly did eventually support the campaign in 1936-1938, financially it was a total disaster. And the only big donation came from Countess Eileen Freehill, and that's where we got the Freehill Tower from. She gave £15,000, but the total collection was about £22,000, which was really nothing compared to the huge amount that had been raised in the 1920s for both St Mary's Cathedral and for the chapel and other buildings at St Patrick's College at Manly. So St John's was really sort of put into the bin of too difficult, too hard, you know, we don't want to have to deal with Maurice O'Reilly.
Thank you very much for that. And I guess that has a little bit to do with the number of Catholics that have entering professional occupations as well at that time and being educated at the university and, you know, that sort of thing. But a second question, if I may, it's sort of like the role of the fellows of the college under the legislation, because it's kind of like they were just there in the background rather than having any meaningful role, particularly if the college infrastructure is kind of falling apart.
Yes. Well, the reason for that is that all of the money was spent in building the college building that we see there today, or the first part of it, the main building and the chapel and the dining hall. So after building the building, they had no money. They didn't even have enough money to allow students to come in because they couldn't afford to feed them or to house them. So there was a moment immediately after the building was completed where there was a motion before the fellows that they should not open the college. So it was a complete disaster. The only way, and by that time John Forrest had been brought from Ireland and was actually there on the site, and he intervened and he said, look guys, I will guarantee, using my £500 salary from the government, the operation of the college. And of course this was a disaster, because once Forrest had accepted the responsibility, all of the other rectors in succession then had to have personal responsibility for the running of the college. So the fellows were able to sit back, have their meetings every couple of months, pontificate about what should be done in the college, but they were never prepared to put their hands in their pockets and to actually pay for anything to be done. And I feel very sorry for Monsignor O'Brien, because he came to the college, and there's actually correspondence between Cardinal Moran and the Archbishop of Dublin saying Father O'Brien doesn't need to know about the financial arrangements. We'll sort it out when he gets here. And Moran actually said, I will make sure that the college is full. Of course, that didn't happen. So, financial difficulties were at the bottom of most of the college's problems, and they weren't helped by the fellows. And the fellows were not very wealthy people, mostly. They were professionals, lawyers, doctors who'd done well, but most of them had come from fairly, you know, sort of lower middle class backgrounds, first in family, many of them scholarship boys, this sort of thing. So they didn't really have the resources to make a big difference. So, whereas at St Paul's, you might have had a slightly different group of people who were on the council there.
Peter, you've mentioned Kelly a couple of times. I must say that one of my favourite entries in the Australian Dictionary of Biography, I think it's by Tony Cole, and it's about Archbishop Kelly, and it's scarifying. It's a wonderful piece.
Archbishop Kelly was a very difficult character, and you really had to watch yourself when dealing with... everyone thinks that Cardinal Moran was the one who was difficult, but actually I think Kelly was far worse. And if you got on the wrong side of Kelly, you're in big trouble. And there's also a side of Kelly which is... And I guess this is... you find it with the hierarchy. There's an element of realpolitik at work, and they sort of... You know, the truth to them is a little bit malleable, and memories of what was agreed and what was said sometimes change, sometimes quite considerably change. And but Kelly said things that were really quite outrageous, and Mind you, O'Reilly was also saying things that were totally outrageous. I've read the correspondence to the Archbishop, and I just think, well, I'm surprised he wasn't excommunicated if he's, you know, writing to his ecclesiastical superior in this way. He had absolutely no fear of Kelly and would tell Kelly, you know, to his face what he thought of him, basically. But yes, Kelly's quite a character.
Peter, you've spoken of the recurrent theme of failure in the history of the college. I had occasion a couple of years ago to look at the very early period of foundation of the college, and one of the things that impressed me was the alacrity with which the Catholic community subscribed and indeed oversubscribed very, very quickly for the foundation of the college, and the fundraising to meet the requirements of the Affiliated Colleges Partial Endowment Act was a thumping success. And yet what followed afterwards does appear to have been recurrent episodes of failure in one way or another. My question is, and this may be an invidious question, you may be hesitant to respond, but have you formed any even tentative view at this stage as to whether there's any underlying consistent cause or consistent pattern of causes to which these repeated episodes of failure can be attributed? And also, are there any historical analogies of similar institutions here or in other countries where the same pattern has played out and possibly for corresponding sorts of reasons?
Yeah. Thanks, Carl. That's a good question. Carl's actually worked on the history of the college, and especially the original 1850 Act, and his work on the 1858 Act is really the locus classicus that everyone needs to refer to. So, yes, look, you're right, Carl. The fundraising in 1857 was enormously successful. Everyone was amazed. And it was a sort of a reconciliation process in a way, bringing the Catholic community together after this terrible period of upheaval, based on, you know, what was happening with the Freeman's Journal and the opposing factions. So yes, it was hugely successful, except many of those donations were promises. And when people were asked to honour their promise, some of them reneged. So, yes, there is this sense in which it was a very successful fundraising campaign, but the reason that they ran out of money was that some of the donors didn't stump up with what they'd agreed to give. So right at the very start, you've got this problem. And this was something that the fellows talked about all the time. They were intensely worried about what they would do. They had to chop off the back cloister and put up a wooden structure instead of the masonry one they were hoping for. The stairs to the dining hall were chopped out, and a wooden set were put there, rickety old wooden stairs up to the dining hall. Dining hall and chapel weren't even open until Archbishop Vaughan became rector. They were just cobwebbed open spaces that no one used. So the place and the tower had been chopped out of the plan as well. So the place was derelict right from the beginning, actually. And I think that, and in some of Wardell's correspondence, the architect, William Wilkinson Wardell, he says it's not going to matter having a half-completed college because this will give something to aspire to. You know, the Sydney Catholics will look at St John's and they'll say, we need to give more money so that it can be built to its glorious, you know, plan. But that didn't happen. I think the Sydney Catholics looked at the place and said, well, you know, we've given all this money and what's happened to it? The place looks a wreck. And that also got under the skin of the fellows too, I think. And so the council became dysfunctional right from the very beginning. because you had represented on the council all the different factions within the Catholic community. So they were always arguing along party lines. And there's some terrible scurrilous stuff that's recorded in the minutes. So I think that right at the heart of the institution, and you have to remember for the first 20 or 30 years, it was a college of fellows. There were more fellows than students, because there were hardly any students. In 1873 and 1874, there were no students in the college. So, you know, you have a combination of these factors, which I think over time, also the interference of the Archbishop Visitor, who thinks he should have more authority in the college, but is not given the authority that he wants. And this, of course, creates stresses between the Metropolitan and the college. But if you... I mean, the other example, you've asked for another example, I would say St Andrew's College on the other side of the campus. There's a very good book that's been written about St Andrew's College and these tensions that are built into the relationship, the governing relationship within the college, because you have fellows who are not fellows in the classic Oxford-Cambridge pattern, who are the academics who run the college. These are laymen mostly and clerics who really don't know much about universities at all. You then have the rector or the principal who is having to go to the fellows to get stuff done, even though they don't really listen to the rector very often. And then eventually you have this body of graduates who elect the fellows. And, you know, one of the issues in the early 2000s, many people would say, is that you had this bunch of rah-rah old boys on the council who didn't really care about some of the terrible stuff that was going on, and therefore there had to be another way to get different influences in. And at the same time, you've got what at St John's is called the house, the students, the current residents, and they have their own command structure under the house president, and for many years the students ran their own disciplinary proceedings and they managed their own lives. And this is one of the failings of Father Thompson and the Vincentians. And it's one of the reasons that Bishop Carroll advised Cardinal Gilroy that the college had to be brought back under the control of a diocesan priest. And that's why they chose Father Bernheim. He wasn't the only nominee at the time, but he was the one who was eventually chosen by the fellows. So there are all of these stresses and strains within the relationship between these different groups. And I've just forgotten for the moment the author of the book about St Andrews, but he says, is it any surprise then that the college is dysfunctional? And I would say the same thing about St John's. Now, of course, saying that in a history of the college is difficult for all sorts of reasons and has to be said carefully.
Thank you.
Was that Ian Jack?
No, it wasn't. No, it was the...
Boy Stole the Rose.
Yes, and I can't... Who was the author of that?
Went Back to Scotland.
He did, yeah. It's a great book, actually.
Okay. Well, it reminds me, there were disputes within the Presbyterian Church between the Wee Freeze and the others. You're putting your finger on one aspect of this, which is the Irish-English question, which has bedeviled Australian history ever since the very beginning, and is still not resolved.
I enjoyed your talk very much. I went to the college in 1943 as a medical student. I was there till 1948. And it was apparent to me the place was pretty dysfunctional. And when I was at school, I was friendly with the Hughes family. And their name was Forrest Hughes. And they were kinsmen of Father Forrest. And they were very unhappy about what happened to Father Forrest. And my friend Jeff Hughes has been dead 20 years or something. He were then told me that. And he also said he was absolutely astounded when the Hughes family were approached for financial support, whenever that time was. So what you've told me has really informed me about things I really didn't know very much about. But I can only say that my astonishment at going to St John's College from Riverview, where I'd been a boarder for 6 years, in 1943 was just astounding. And it remained pretty much the same way the whole time I was there and when Father Thompson was the rector. So I enjoyed very much what you've had to say, and I'm very interested in what you're doing. Thank you.
Peter, do your researches at this stage allow you to come to any conclusions or provisional conclusions about the relationship between St John's College and Sancta Sophia? Yeah,
well, yes. There's a lot of relationships we could talk about, many of them marital, actually, as it turned out, so, and probably a few in this room. And look, I've got to be a bit careful with Father Campion here, because I read a piece by him which talked about the fact that Maurice O'Reilly had thought of Sancta as a hall of St John's, and, you know, this was a completely false way of seeing it. But what I've actually discovered in reading the archives at the Archdiocese is that Sancta was really Maurice O'Reilly's idea. He wanted to have a women's hall at the university, but he wanted it to be a hall under St John's College. And so when the Sisters of the Sacred Heart came to the university, and originally they were in a small house in City Road, Father O'Reilly was very supportive of them, looked after them, wrote to the Archbishop for them, absolutely the worst thing that you could do if you wanted support, I would have thought. But they were very grateful to him at that stage. And I haven't quite got to the bottom of exactly what happened as the foundation process proceeded, but I suspect that either Archbishop Kelly or some of the fellows who were elected, or actually they were the committee members at that stage rather than fellows, decided that it would be better to have Sancta as an independent college rather than a hall under the authority of the Fellows of St John's. And so that's the way that they went. And O'Reilly was on the committee, but he seems not to have gone to the meetings. And when the notice went out in the local press to say we're having the foundation stone blessed for Sancta Sophia, O'Reilly actually wrote to, Mother McCrory or some, I can't remember who, but he wrote to Mother whatever, and said, is something happening? I've not been informed, and this is our hall. You need to tell us what's going on. Are we going to get an invitation? So I think there's, there were things happening at that stage which then took Sancta out of the realm of St John's. But of course, St John, the Fellows of St John's were very generous to Sancta in giving a very large chunk of ground that had been part of the original St John's grant, and that was actually extended beyond what they'd originally asked for. So, I mean, the Sancta John's relationship over the years, there were various attempts to bring the two colleges back together again. There were plans to have joint dining and other facilities. Before St John's went co-ed, there was an option where the two colleges could join. But I suspect that the Council of Sancta would not have wanted that, because Sancta was doing very well. It was John's, actually, that wasn't doing so well by that time. Sancta was full and doing very well. So, but I haven't actually looked at all of the records yet, Jack, so perhaps at another time I can talk more fully about that. I've talked to Margaret, though, so...
This is not a historian's comment at all, but the story and the myth at Sancta is that we stopped John's managing us, and the laying of the foundation stone was put in a place where nobody sees it. It was considered to be a feminist victory. Now, that may be just myth.
But we used their oval to get the lectures.
Good use of it.
Well, on that note,
we always walked over St John's Oval in order to get to our lecture.
Jared, do you want to say something? We'll make this the last comment or question.
Just to get out of the nitty-gritty of undergraduates, I mean, you mentioned the word lack of discipline or disciplinary problems a number of times. What did they consist of, and were there periods in which they were more up and down? I mean, I'm thinking, for example, my father was there in the mid-30s. Now, certainly, Fresh has got a bad time. I mean, his particular memory was that Freshers were bundled out of bed. Their beds were dismantled, their old iron bedsteads. They were taken down onto the John's Oval. Screws and all were scattered throughout every part of the Oval, and the poor buddy Fresher would have to try and find them all and put it all together again and so on.
Yes, I'm sure that Harry must have been involved in a lot of that once he became a senior too. But things got worse as time went on. John Bernheim came into the college wanting to put an end to it. He was fairly determined that he would. But for whatever reason, Bernheim didn't really get on top of the problem. And I think in 1963, a parent wrote an anonymous letter to John Bernheim and basically said, if you as a Catholic priest can allow the sorts of things to go on in your college, which I know are occurring, then you will burn in hell, and quite rightly so. I mean, very, very blunt language. And it was a very supportive letter in many ways. You know, he's deeply concerned about the college. But what had happened, and don't forget that this is the year, 1963, when the first Aboriginal student at the University of Sydney came to St John's to reside, and we had a number of Papua New Guinean students as well. In that year, the House Committee President took one of the freshers and had him stripped, and his back was blacked with boot black. And this was something that Father Bernheim didn't know about. Of course, when he did hear about it, all hell broke loose. And he basically said, this will stop now, that, you know, there are going to be expulsions, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, it was said earlier that John Bernheim feels that these were 10 lost years that he had at St John's. And I think what happened after 1963 was that things just crept back. And, you know, he couldn't get rid of this cancer in the place. And it was still there in 1979. It was still there when I arrived in 85 from Armidale, and I thought we were pretty tough in Armidale. But my goodness, the boys at St Albert's College had nothing on the guys at St John's, what they were getting up to. So, you know, they're very serious events that were occurring, and that's, I mean, you might think boot blacking is not that bad, but there's a lot of other stuff that went on. And these were problems that escalated, I think, in the 1990s. And then, of course, you get reports in the Sydney Morning Herald about some of the more serious things that happened and, you know, the sexual abuse that was taking place. And, you know, as an historian, you know, when you're trying to think of a structure that you're going to give the book to make the story work, one of the things I've thought is, has the college fulfilled the dreams of its founders? And I think this is where Tony Carle got into such trouble, because you have to say no, it's been a disaster. I'm glad to say though, Rector, and the Rector is present here today, that I think things have improved enormously since the bad old days, and I think that perhaps, and this is where I see a glimmer of light at the end of the tunnel, that if as we move into the future, I think that things are, they're much more, the organisation of the place is better, the funding of the place is better, the students are selected more carefully, you know, in every way the college is much better organised than it was when I was there in the 1980s. So I do have hope. But I still find it difficult to bring all of this history into the book in such a way that, people won't be very upset by what I have to say about the college.
Thanks. School of a boy, Brian Kinsella, who went to John's in 63 and left soon after, I believe because he was bullied mercilessly. His grandfather was a judge, you know, famous old Catholic judge, Judge Kinsella, at the time. Brian never got a degree. Was called up, went to Vietnam as an intelligence officer and so on. But I don't know. He was a very bright boy, and the very fact that he never took a degree was a bit of an oddity even then.
Yeah. The college was put on notice at various times, and Harding would be able to tell you about the 1943 memorandum, which he actually signed, that went to the Archbishop, where they made a series of complaints, some of them about food, others about more serious matters. But these are issues that were well known over a long period. And, yes, students just left in their droves because they couldn't cope with what they found, and you can't blame them.
Well, thank you very much, Peter. This afternoon we've heard something quite extraordinary. We've heard a professional historian talking about the general challenges of writing history, giving a history a structure. That's a problem for every composer, painter, novelist as well. But it's particularly acute with historians who are supposed to be telling the truth, not imagination. So I think we've been extraordinarily lucky to hear this talk from someone who's both been an insider and an outsider and is facing those problems. So I think that we're all very lucky. Could I just point out the next month's meeting, which won't appear, I think, quite so early in the month. It is the third Sunday today, even though the month is scarcely half over. But next month, we're going to be getting Professor Stephen McIntyre, who gave us a wonderful talk on the death of Les Murray, talking about understanding Australian religious poetry through reading it. So could I recommend that as being something, because he's a very special person and a poet himself. Thank you all very much, but indeed, thank you very much, Peter.
We've been listening to Dr. Peter Kunich speaking at the 15 October 2023 meeting of the Australian Catholic Historical Society on Writing a History of St John's College, University of Sydney. Dr. John Carmody moderated the Q&A. The author of the work about St Andrew's College, referred to by our speaker, would be the Reverend Dr. Peter Cameron, Principal of St Andrew's College from 1991 to 1995. His work of 201 pages is entitled Finishing School for Blokes, College Life Exposed, and it was published in 2007 by Allen and Unwin. ACHS meetings are held at 2 p.m. on the third Sunday of each month from February to November in the Crypt of St Patrick's, Churchill, 20 Grosvenor Street, The Rocks, Sydney. Please go to the ACHS website for details of our full program of talks. You're most welcome to join us on Sunday the 19th of November 2023 at St Pat's, where our speaker will be Dr Stephen McInerney of Campion College, Sydney. Stephen will present A Panorama of Australian Religious Poetry Through Reading It. ACHS talks are recorded on Gadigal Country, and the podcasts are produced on Wallumedegal Country by me, John Kenny. Goodbye for now. Please go safely.